Hello, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this podcast from ABF, the Soldiers Charity. No chitty, no pity, as the regimental medical officer might say. After a break in which flu did its best, but not its damnedest, General Talk is back, and while it may be long in the coming, in this case, it would be remiss of me not to wish you all a very happy, if belated, new year. Just over 15 months since taking over the helm as ABF's chief executive, my guest on the programme is Major General Tim Hyams, who talks to me about the challenges the Soldiers' Charity faces as we come out of COVID, his career in the army, and two very different roles as Honorary Colonel of the Royal Dragoon Guards and the Queen's Own Yeomanry. I hope you enjoy the programme. Tim, you joined an army in 1986 that our grandfathers would have recognised. After 35 years, the digital spectrum was now a theatre of war, and the army is much reduced and a much changed institution. You completed your service as Director of Land Warfare and Military Secretary, General Officer in Scotland. What was the attraction to ABF and the job as Chief Executive of the charity?
So, particularly in the latter part of my time in the army, did a number of roles that were around personnel issues, strategy and delivery, and a lot of time previous to that at regimental duty. And I think what attracted me to the Army Benevolent Fund was the ability to give a little bit back to the people that really matter, the soldiers, and to continue to try to do my little bit to look after them. So it felt like the next logical stage in what I view to be a vocation.
You took over as chief executive from Martin Rutledge at the end of 2021. What are your impressions of the charity there on day one when you walked into office?
Firstly, it was very evident to me that all the work that had gone on during Martin's tenure, and he was here for 10 years, and that what I was fortunate enough to be inheriting was a really business-like organisation, really focused on delivering benevolence. The second thing was that there was a really interesting and heady mix of ex-military and people who've grown up not in the army but in fundraising or communications and marketing and finance and IT. So a really interesting mix, eclectic mix of people with huge amounts of skills, which when you bring them together is a really powerful combination. But I think what's really interesting is whether it's the soldiers who've spent 30 or so years as officers or soldiers and are now in the charity, or the people who've come up one of those professional routes, it's the amazing sense of a team that's come together and a shared sense of purpose. And people who come into the charity rapidly assimilate the value of the charity, the values of the charity, and the importance of what they do for our soldiers and our veterans and their families, which is really quite humbling.
You're a year into the post, and you have a chance to assess and to see and to get your feet under the table. What are your priorities and what are your plans to imprint the Tim Hyams magic onto ABF?
Well, I think that the first thing was always the operating context. And we've just had the census, so we have a much clearer understanding of the community we serve in terms of the veterans. And broadly speaking, there are some 2 million veterans out there. It is estimated reduced to about 1.6 million by 2028. I think that's a manifestation of very sadly, the World War II and the National Service veterans passing and the move then actually to a veteran community that reflects the post-National Service regular Army and the Reserve. But at the same time, interestingly, 44% of our veterans are now below the age of 65. So a smaller, relatively smaller community, but younger, therefore going to, when they fall in need, live with that need for longer. That need will be more complex. And so whilst necessarily the overall numbers of people coming might reduce, the complexity and therefore the cost of that need is going to increase. So there's a real requirement to make sure that we're positioned to meet that. And I think as we come out of the end of the COVID era, which Martin and the team navigated so brilliantly, the opportunity and requirement now is to reset, to take the opportunity to have a more long-term plan. Long-term plan in terms of raising the money we need in order to meet that need. And you know that this charity doesn't receive public funding. It relies entirely on the generosity of its supporters, and they are amazing supporters who support us so loyally and fantastically, and I'm extremely grateful for that. So that is part of the challenge, is having a more long-term plan to how we're going to raise that money. But in parallel, I think the only reason we raise that money is to deliver the benevolence to those that need it, and therefore making sure that our plans for benevolence, whether that's through the grants to individuals in support of the regiment and corps charities, because I'm very clear that soldiers associate first and foremost with their regiment, and so it's to their regiment that they will turn, and we as the Army's national charities support those regiment charities to look after their people when they fall into need. So that's the first thing we do, individual need. The second is the grants that we give to delivery charities and organisations, some 66 last year, probably going up to closer to 75 in the coming year. And that's really important, because that allows us to invest on behalf of the whole Army family and the regimental charities, and there's an efficiency in doing that, in those delivery charities so they can give specialist support to those who fall into need. And then finally, through the support we give to the wider military ecosystem, so the money we give to those who deliver the casework, which gives us the evidence so that we understand that we're meeting genuine need, not people who you know might not necessarily be in such absolute need. Funding all the regimental charities to be members of the Confederation of Service Charities so that they don't have to contact that burden. So that through those three things, that we not only meet the immediacy of need when people fall into it, but also really see where we can to take a more long-term approach to address underlying causation. Because if cases are more complex and more long-lasting, the requirement for us to really get under the skin and address that underlying causation of mental health, housing, education, employment, you know, family and marital issues, those who sadly have drug and alcohol dependencies. It's all of those things in combination, and the more we can do to address that before it becomes presented in someone coming to us having fallen into need, then the more we will be on the front foot and delivering a long-term approach.
In 1944, when the charity was established, there were a lot more veterans then. The army was considerably larger. Do you think that the demands that the veterans make on the charity today are more complex than they were then?
I think because people who fall into need present relatively earlier in their lives. Things come together in a much more complicated mix. I think it is slightly misleading to suggest that it was very simple back in the day, but I do think that lives are very complicated now. I think that awareness of issues that probably weren't as immediately obvious to people in the old days. So the full complexity of things like mental health, the impact of what's going on inside relationships, means that if you understand that and you understand how that all comes together, these things present in a much more complex way now. So I do think that the nature of the need that we're meeting has changed over time. And that requires sort of nuanced responses these days. But I think in this, Harry, it's really important that we understand that the vast majority of people who serve in the British Army leave well and are net contributors to society as a result of the values and skills that they've gained through their service. And what our job, our responsibility, is to pick up the relatively small number, and it's about 60,000 to 65,000 each year, which is still quite a lot of people, and give them the support they need so that they also can move forward with their lives with independence and dignity, and they can contribute to society.
We talk about interfacing with the wider populace, so they're aware of the charity's activities. But actually, although the Chief of the General Staff, General Sir Patrick Saunders, described ABF as important a part of the National Army institution as any of the regiments, we also have to work on a profile within the Army too. What's your plan to make people understand that ABF is the Army's national charity?
I think that we may at various stages in our history have been in danger of an assumption that the Army understood us, understood who we were, and understood what we did for it. I think we as a charity need to work very much harder at communicating with the Army, so that it supports us in supporting the Army family, B, so that the next generation of our supporters are drawn through the Army, understanding who we are, and then support us through life. C, they understand that as the Army's national charity, what we do to support their regiments and corps, which is a really powerful message. And the combination of those things, and D, so that they can communicate on our behalf the value of what we do as part of the Army family, on behalf of the Army family. I think that requires us to communicate with the Army in a different way, and it's an Army that communicates with itself in a very different way. I think it is requires us to be much more persistent with our communications. I mean, the Army, everybody changes jobs every 2 years. To assume that the knowledge is passed on from one job holder to another is somewhat fallacious. So we need to work harder at that. And I think also, as the Army's national charity, there's a responsibility to, going back to that point I made about the value of service, communicate actually the value of the Army, the value of service in the Army, to refute the fact that armed soldiers are somehow mad, bad or sad when they leave. No, they're not. And that part of messaging is a positive one to prospective employers and to the wider public about the value of soldiering, the value of soldiers, and therefore the value of what we do for the small minority who need a helping hand.
I mean, General Patrick's analogy that the charity is as important a part of the institution as any of its other regiments is perhaps a good one, because in a small army, where they haven't got the profile or the manpower to go out into the streets and bang the drum, now largely falls the charity to do that on the Army's behalf.
And I think one of the things I'm really keen to do is work with the Army. So there's a benefit to us of soldiers turning up to support us at our events. You know, it resonates much more if there are soldiers there in combats or scarlets or a bearskin or a piper. People want to see that, and it's right, as the Army's national charity, we're seen to be doing that. But also I think that we, and I'm struck on a number of times when I've been out to various events run around the country, we engage with communities who may not be as naturally drawn to the Army itself as they are to us. And I think therefore our ability to work with the Army to explain to communities in this country whose understanding of the Army may be more tangential than others, that's a purchase that I think that we can work with the Army to help in that regard. Because if the Army is to have the diversity of thought and talent, and that's the genuine benefit of diversity, is that thought and talent thing, then it needs to draw from the talent that exists in all the communities, and us helping to reach into those communities and explain the value of the Army and what it does and the value of its people, I think is a really important thing for us to do.
Killing the Quick March of the Royal Dragoon Guards, played by the Band of the Royal Dragoon Guards. You're listening to General Talk with me, Harry Butnell, and my guest, Major General Tim Harms, Chief Executive of ABF, the Soldiers' Charity, the national charity of the British Army.
He's also Colonel of the Royal Dragoon Guards and Queen's Own Yeomanry.
We've talked a lot about change, and no greater illustration of the change that the Army has been through in the last generation, the last 30 years, is your own regiment, the Royal Dragoon Guards. 30 years ago, in 1992, you were the adjutant bringing together the 4th, 7th Royal Dragoon Guards and the 5th Enniskillen Dragoon Guards. What were the challenges you faced then in bringing two very prominent, very experienced and very noble regiments with the gallant past? What were the challenges you faced in bringing those two regiments together as one?
So I think there was a moment of timing as well. You know, and the timing was an accident, because options for change came because one era was coming to a close, and therefore the army was required, for a variety of reasons, to rebalance. So the army that I joined in 1986, I joined the Skins. It was part of the British Army of the Rhine, 1BR Corps. We had, the Armoured Corps had 21 regiments. It's probably about that. But yeah, there were, you know, massed armour on the West German plain, fronting up against the Warsaw Pact. It was an army that operated in a way that your grandfather commanding his corps in World War II would have recognised. You know, 1992, at the moment of amalgamation, the world was changing. The wall had come down. We were facing into sunny uplands or considerable turbulence and uncertainty. And so two regiments that had grown up in one army were required to begin to look into sort of the army that began to emerge and was the army that I experienced in the second or the latter part of my career. So that was the first challenge, was that sort of coming to that philosophical understanding that the days of 1BR Corps were behind it, particularly for cavalry regiments, which had been at the very centre of that. The second challenge was two very proud regiments. One, but, you know, actually, in truth, probably more similar than they care to admit, like most regiments, but quite different. You know, 4/7th Yorkshire Regiment, with all the strengths that Yorkshire brings, all the determination that Yorkshire brings. Skins, at its heart, an Irish regiment, but recruiting from England as well. You know, and the point about being a skin was not that you came from Enniskillen, but that was home. Mm-hmm. And you went, that was your idea of home, and there was a sense of place. And it didn't matter where you came from, you associated with that. But that sense of Irishness, which, you know, you will understand from the Irish Guards. And as adjutant, the last adjutant of the Skins, I always characterised as, you know, a bit like sitting on a gunpowder. You knew there was a fuse burning somewhere, just weren't sure where it was or where it was going to go off. But that was the joy of that. So it's a quite different in character, and trying to bring those together and draw the best of both and bring them together. But then at a very human level, how you integrated people into tank crews, which is how we operate, that idea of crew, which brings a very different style of leadership. It brings a different ethos. And the way we did that was simply to, you know, if the crew commander was, the tank commander was going to be a 4/7th Royal Dragoon Guard, his loader was going to be a skin, the gunner was going to be a 4/7th, and the driver. We went down to that level of detail of planning. If the squadron leader was a skin, then the squadron sergeant major was going to be 4/7th, all the way down. And then at the instigation of the commanding officer, Johnny Torrance Spence, the first thing we did was go straight out on exercise for almost a month. And the dynamics of a tank crew are, there is nowhere to hide. You know, I say to the officer cadets who want to join the regiment now, every emotion of yours will be laid bare to soldiers, because they can see you from feet away. So you can't hide. And so if you spend 3 weeks in a tank together, other than being very smelly by the end of it, you get to know people. And barriers break down, and the view that, you know, the skins are rubbish and the 4/7th are this, well, actually, you soon learn that they're not, and he's a good driver and you're a good gunner, and you bring together.
It's a rebirth. In that sense, the amalgamation of the 15th, 19th and the 13th, 18th, when they became the Light Dragoons, a completely new entity. I think, in a way, that was a good option, because it meant everybody had a brand new start.
So I absolutely do, actually. And I think that we sometimes misunderstand the difference between the regimental system and its manifestation at any one point in time. The regimental system, I think, is a fundamentally important part of the British Army and how it delivers fighting power. In essence, it is about getting a group of individuals to gel together, to believe in each other and be willing to fight for each other. And that's fundamentally what we're talking about, small unit cohesion. And because we're British, it manifests in the regimental system, and you put badges and buttons and things around that to give it a sense of purpose and meaning and understanding. Sometimes people get caught up in the manifestation at a point in time and say, well, we can't move on from being the Blankshires because the Blankshires are this. I think when you get the other side of it, and having now been a Royal Chicken Guard for a lot longer than I was a skin, I'm enormously proud of having been that skin for the time that I was. But I'm also equally proud of the Royal Chicken Guards, and I'm quite certain that people will fight as hard for the Royal Chicken Guards as anybody would fought for the skins.
Absolutely.
Because they've come to understand that.
You speak with great pride of it, and actually you are Colonel of the Royal Chicken Guards now, which is a great accolade and a great achievement. But also your son, Ollie, is a ninth generation officer in
the regiment. He is.
How does he feel about serving in a modern kind of regiment, especially when you talk about the emotion of bringing this regiment together and creating the spirit, but at a time when you haven't got any armour, which slightly takes its raison d'etre away, that must be a degree of soul-searching. You know, how do we make this work? How do we create, how do we maintain ourselves and others? Are we going to be cut again?
So I think there's two parts to that. The first part is the sort of the institutional side. And one of the things that we have done of late is, so the regiment's 30 years old. And the analogy I use is that the two proud parents gave birth to this child. We've watched it grow through being a toddler to an adolescent. It's now a fully formed adult. And I think that the responsibility of the parents is to allow that adult to be its own person. We've been trying to be very clear about what makes the Royal Chicken Guards the Royal Chicken Guards rather than just the son of the skins and the 47th. And so we've been very clear about defining those things that absolutely define us as Royal Chicken Guards. And that's given a sense of purpose, a sense of character and identity to the modern regiment, which it can look forward and take forward while still being enormously proud of its parents and never forgetting the upbringing the parents have given it. But it's its own man now, and it's going to make its way as the Royal Chicken Guards. We've taken a couple of bits of symbology. One was the regimental flash of the 47th, which is the oldest regimental flash in the army, which was worn at Dunkirk. Interestingly, when the two regiments amalgamated to form the rear guard, whilst the rest of the BAF got away, and then when the 47th were the first people back across Gold Beach. So that speaks to operational capability, which I'll come back to in a minute, the second part, and credibility. And the second element we've taken is the Watergate of Enniskillen. You can go to Enniskillen and stand on the flagstones where the Enniskillens were raised in 1685. And that gives us a sense of family, of home, and of that sort of purpose in that sense. And you put those two together, and it's a really powerful mix of family regiment and capability, which gives a very clear ethos and understanding. To your second point, and it's interesting watching, you know, I described the army I started in, then there was the army that I served in the sort of second half of my career, which was much more of a three-dimensional air, land, with surveillance and intelligence, which meant we had a much clearer understanding of where the enemy might be and the operating context in which we're. And we were much more joined up, I think, in terms of genuine air, land, in terms of doing things. Still not as precise as the army that Ollie is now moving into. But that was the second. I think where the regiment, where Ollie find themselves now and moving forward, is in a slightly changed character of war. So I think that, you know, the nature of warfare doesn't change. It's involving contest between humans in complex human and real terrain. But I think where the regiment find itself now is an air, land and cyber. So that is the additional complexity that brings it, but also brings more precision and more focus. So to Patrick Sanders' view, you know, you can't cyber your way across a river, but cyber can do an awful lot about what's the other side of the river for when you get there. So that's the third sort of army that we've moved through. I've moved through the first two, my son's now in the third. And that's the challenge for the regiment. The regiment has moved from being a tank regiment to an armoured cavalry regiment. It's currently equipped with Warrior. The Warrior gives them a very credible platform, which they absolutely can hone their skills in delivering that capability and in preparation for getting what comes afterwards.
You leave the military, you are now chief executive of the Soldiers' Charity. You're colonel of your regiment, the Royal Dragoon Guards, but quite uniquely, you're also colonel of the Queen's Own Yeomanry. The army today relies a great deal more, and has to rely a great deal more, on its reserves. How do you find the change from a regular regiment to a reserve regiment?
Again, there's more that binds people together than separates them. I'm enormously privileged to be colonel regiment, Queen's Own Yeomanry. Fundamentally, yeomen or cavalrymen, they are armoured corps soldiers. They are soldiers at heart. But I think there is a distinction, and quite clearly, the regular cavalrymen in the Royal Dragoon Guards, they are full-time professional soldiers who focus exclusively on their trade as such. The yeomen are part-time soldiers. They're none the less professional for what they do, but they are bounded in terms of the time that they are able to devote to it, because that is what they do in their spare time in between their main job and, of course, the other thing going on in their lives, their families, which makes, I find, even more humbling what they do weekends and other times when they're there. But they are canny, they are intelligent, they bring a very broad perspective from a range of jobs and communities to bear. I mean, the Queen's Own Yeomanry, all across the north of England, both northeast and northwest. And I think it is the combination of the two. So, you know, going back a little bit, commanding the regiment in Iraq, which again was a hugely privileged to do, we had a troop of yeomen join us, and they brought a very different perspective to it and a very different skill set. And we put them to a very discreet surveillance task within the battle group, and they brought really innovative thinking to it. And they did it probably better than the regular soldiers would have done, because they completely thought out of the box about what they're going to do.
The reservists, do they have an equal call on ABF's charitable resources?
So we make no distinction. So we are here for the army family in its totality. Soldier, serving, soldier, veteran, and immediate families, whether they were regular or reserve. Mm. And in many cases, actually, a number of regulars become reservists and a number of reservists become regular, so the distinction is blurred, and I think in future the army will look increasingly and view people as either doing a part-time job or a full-time job as a soldier, with much more flexibility between how people move between those two employments, which reinforces the need for us to look after everyone in the family. The time that I'm privileged to spend with the Queen's Own Yeomanry, I'm really struck by the commitment and passion they have to that regiment. I have no doubt in my mind, you know, that they're as dedicated and professional as anybody else.
As chief executive here, and as colonel of the Royal Dragoon Guards, as colonel of Queen's Own Yeomanry, the calls on your time outside office hours must be horrendous. When you're not wearing your mess kit or wandering around wearing the distinctive red, green and blue of the Army Benevolent Fund, what does General Tim Harms get up to in his downtime?
Like most of the men in the family, there's a mild obsession about rugby union. So that takes up quite a lot of time, whether that's watching Bath play, rather better this season than last year. I enjoy reading history and fiction and walking. So I will be going to the Caterham Yomp, and I will be walking the Caterham Yomp and various bits of it to meet as many people as I can. The problem with entering it is you then don't meet very many people along the route, and part of the reason to go is to see as many people who are doing it as possible.
General Tim Harms, thank you so much for being my guest today on General Talk.
It's been fun. A real privilege. Thanks a lot.
And my thanks to Major General Tim Harms for being my guest on this month's General Talk. For further information on events being run by the charity, from jazz evenings to the Lord Mayor's Big Curry Lunch to the Caterham Yomp, please visit the ABF website at soldierscharity.org. Join us next month as we begin the build-up to His Majesty the King's coronation on the 6th of May. And until then, as you step off to Jacken John Peel, the regimental march of the Queen's Own Yeomanry, from me, Harry Bucknell, keep smiling through, thank you for listening, and farewell. John Peel, was played by the band of the Royal Regiment of Artillery. With studio editing by Steve Campen at Creative Radio, this has been a Gamekeeper production for ABF, the Soldiers' Charity.